From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Robert Hass has been called a poet of domestic passions, and indeed his work often deals with his own family. On this edition of Fresh Air, Robert Hass reads from his latest collection, Human Wishes. Also today we meet comic and actor Rick Aviles. He started out doing stand-up on New York street corners. Now he's in Jim Jarmusch's new movie, Mystery Train. World music critic Milo Miles plays music from Tanzania, and critic-at-large Laurie Stone reviews political comic Jimmy Tingle. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. President Bush, in a news conference at the White House today, said the United States is not seeking a deal with former Panamanian dictator Manuel Noriega, but the president refused to rule out the possibility of such an arrangement. We get more from NPR's Jim Angle at the White House.
The president met with his attorney general, Richard Thornburg, today to discuss the legal process in the Noriega case, then offered this assessment to reporters.
The attorney general assures me that our case is strong, our resolve is firm, and our legal representations are sound.
Though the president said the government isn't seeking a deal with Noriega, he indicated that wouldn't stop Noriega from proposing one, and the president declined to rule out any sort of plea bargain in exchange for information about international drug traffickers. Mr. Bush has acknowledged the U.S. invasion of Panama created a lot of diplomatic damage, especially with the Latin American countries. So he's sending Vice President Quayle on a mission to the region to explain U.S. thinking and try to patch things up. I'm Jim Angle at the White House.
The State Department said today the United States is prepared to provide up to $3 million to help relocate the Nicaraguan Contras. State Department spokesman Richard Boucher said the money will be given to an international commission if democratic conditions exist in Nicaragua. The disclosure was part of what appears to be an increase in diplomatic activity concerning the fate of the rebels as the Nicaraguan elections draw near. In Iraq, President Saddam Hussein has put forward three proposals, which he said will revive stalled peace negotiations with Iran. The proposals came in a speech marking the 69th anniversary of the Iraqi army. Mike Theodulo reports from Nicosia.
The Iraqi leader called for direct talks between Baghdad and Tehran, the unconditional release of sick and wounded prisoners of war, and the opening of their common border so that pilgrims could resume visits to Islamic shrines in both countries. There's been no response yet from Tehran, though it's likely Iran will reject the package. This is because it sidesteps a key UN Security Council resolution, which Iran insists is the only basis for lasting peace. Iran's main demand, the withdrawal of Iraqi troops from more than 1,000 square miles of Iranian soil, is an integral part of Resolution 598. It was this resolution that brought about the ceasefire 17 months ago, but there's been no progress since on its other provisions. National Public Radio, I'm Mike Theodulu in Nicosia.
The local Communist Party chief in Soviet Azerbaijan has quit because of violence along the border with Iran. Soviet television showed pictures of frontier installations destroyed in nearly a week of turmoil, and border guards said they could not provide full security. Azerbaijani officials say the protesters demand the opening of the border areas for cultivation and the establishment of easier contacts with Azeris across the border. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 22 points to close at 2773.25. This is NPR News. New Jersey's attorney general today removed from office a prosecutor who claimed that assassins tried to kill him in his car New Year's Day. Officials say the alleged attack was a hoax. Attorney General Peter Petrelli told news conference that Camden County prosecutor Samuel Asbelt resigned after he was confronted with a state police report based on an intensive four-day investigation. Officials in Kansas City say 13 members of a religious group have been charged with the murder of a family of five. The murders took place in northeastern Ohio, but seven people have been arrested in the Kansas City area. Mary Jo Draper from member station KCUR has this report.
The Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms in Kansas City received a tip that led authorities to a farm in Kirtland, Ohio. They found the decomposed bodies of Dennis and Cheryl Avery and their three children, who died in April. Agents refused to discuss a motive for the killings. Published reports say they may have been part of a religious sacrifice. The Averys and those indicted all were members of a 29-member religious group, which had split off from the reorganized Church of Latter-day Saints in Independence, Missouri. Several of those arrested have since been living in Independence in nearby Kansas City. They'll be extradited to Ohio to face charges of murder and conspiracy to commit murder. For National Public Radio, I'm Mary Jo Draper in Kansas City.
Phoenix millionaire Charles Keating today said that he used a tax-sharing arrangement at his Lincoln Savings and Loan Association. He denied, rather, that he used that to siphon off $94 million. The arrangement between the fallen thrift and its holding company is a centerpiece of regulators' contention that Keating was illegally using Lincoln as a piggy bank for massive real estate ventures. He testified today in his suit seeking to overturn the government's takeover of the Lincoln Savings and Loan. I'm Frank Stacio, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Back in 1969, I took a poetry class that I'll never forget. It was at the State University of New York at Buffalo. Almost every week, it seemed, the teacher brought in a guest poet to read. Poets like Allen Ginsberg, Gregory Corso, Ed Dorn, and Denise Levertov. And each reading was an event you wouldn't want to miss. The teacher was a young poet named Robert Hass. I never got to know him. After all, the class was in one of those big lecture halls. Well, Robert Hass went on to win the Yale Younger Poets Award in 1972 and wrote several other acclaimed collections. He's also translated poems by the Czech writer Czeslaw Miloš. Hass has a new book of poems called Human Wishes, so I thought this would be a good time to talk with him about his poetry. He lives in the San Francisco area, and we invited him to the studios of KQED. Poet Carolyn Kaiser reviewed Human Wishes in the New York Times. She described Hass as a poet of domestic passion for children, friends, the household, the neighborhood, for women as lovers, women as friends. I asked Hass if he thought that was an accurate description.
I think that it's certainly true of one side of my work. I write a lot about family life, or have written a lot about family life.
Why do you think?
Well, I think there are a couple of reasons, but one is just that it was what was given to me to write about in a certain way. I married when I was young and I had kids, and so it was the life that I wrote out of. I also think that starting to write in the Vietnam years, there was such a sense of violence in the world around that in some maybe predictable middle class way, I found myself writing about and out of the family as a center of life from which which was both, say, from and imperiled by the sense of violence in the world around.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a poem that I'd like you to read an excerpt from, and this poem has a lot to do with family. Would you put this excerpt in context for us?
Well, this poem is called Santa Barbara Road. It's a poem about family life. It's something like picking up a bunch of developed photographs that you've taken over the years, partly of children. I was trying to convey some of what it was like to live in a family and particularly to do it over time, the way children change and grow up. And this particular section of the poem begins with an announcement of how old my son is. You can tell from where he is in school. So should I read?
Go ahead.
Leaf comes home from the last day of his sophomore year. I'm sitting on the stoop by our half-dug, still-imagined kitchen porch, reading Han Dynasty rhyme prose. He puts a hand on my shoulder, grown to exactly my height and still growing. Dad, he says, I'm not taking any more of this tyrannical bullshit. I read to him from Chia Ya. The great man is without bent. A million changes are as one to him. He says, and another thing, don't lay your Buddhist trips on me. The span of life is faded. Man cannot guess its ending. In stillness like the stillness of deep springs. In the kitchen, he flips the lid of the blueberry yogurt. I am thinking this project is more work than I want. Joining, scattering, ebbing and flowing. Where is their persistence? Where is their rule? Bullshit, he mutters. What is the existential reality? He has just read Nausea in Advanced English of all this bullshit, Toto. Toto is the dog. It occurs to me that I may not be a very satisfying parent to rebel against. Like an unmoored boat drifting aimlessly, not even valuing the breath of life, the wise man embraces nothing and drifts with it. I look at his long body in a chair and wonder if I tell him to embrace the void. I think he will embrace a lover soon. I want the stars to terrify him once. I want him to weep bitterly when his grandfather dies, hating the floral carpet, hating it that his old aunts have become expert at an obscene event. I would ward off, if I could, the thicket of grief on grief in which Chiya came to entire relinquishment as to a clearing. Digging again, I say, you know, I started this job, and I hate it already, and now I have to finish. He leans against the doorpost with a spoon, takes a mouthful. Well, Pop, he says, that's life.
Tell me what it was like for you to be quoting Eastern poets and philosophers to your son and having him tell you that it was baloney and resisting you.
It was a teasing relationship, I think, and I think it's necessary for teenagers to shake off what their parents have in mind for them. So I actually liked that period in their lives. I mean, I have one who's still a teenager, but I liked that time a lot. That slightly adversarial tugging that went on in those years.
Poet Robert Hass is my guest, and his new collection of poems is called Human Wishes. Asian poetry has influenced your writing a lot, as we could hear in the poem that you just read. How were you first exposed to it?
I think it was in the air in California when I was growing up. When I was in high school, the beat poets were beginning to read in San Francisco and beginning to publish. And so as soon as I started reading the poems of Gary Snyder, that sent me back to the poems of Kenneth Rexroth and his translations of Japanese and Chinese poetry. And Rexroth, in turn, sent me back to Ezra Pound's translation of Chinese. Chinese poetry has been crucial for American poetry in the 20th century. And so it was very much in the air, and probably more so on the West Coast. So it came quite naturally.
I don't know if this is at all accurate or not, but I sometimes think of Chinese and Japanese poetry as about reflecting more on perception, on what is seen, rather than looking inside and being autobiographical or, you know, thinking about something that you've experienced.
Well, there, of course, we're talking about thousands of years of poetry, the two cultures combined.
Right, and what I've said is absurdly general.
But so if you think about the early Japanese poetry, like the poetry of Lady Komachi, it's a lot like Sappho. It's interior and it's erotic and it's full of longing. But there is a tradition, and it was the tradition that that came into American poetry, of poetry of perception, especially perception of nature. And it had the quality, in English translation anyway, of being amazingly clear-headed. And so just at the time when American poetry was trying to, I think Ezra Pound said, clean the windows of perception, clear the mind, this wonderfully clear-headed, fresh seeing poetry out of Tang Dynasty China began to be translated, and it seemed to a lot of people just what they were looking for in the way of a new way of seeing.
Is that what you wanted too in your poetry, to get that sense of freshness and cleanness?
Well, it was tremendously attractive to me at the time that I started writing. You live a life, and what you want to get at changes.
Yeah.
And I think maybe when I started writing that work, which was a lot like, in its clarity, the descriptive parts of Hemingway and of a lot of American male writing, it was very appealing to me. And then later, when it came to seem that I just wanted to deal with other more complicated, what did you say, more psychological and interior materials, then I needed another idiom than that. It was true that kind of writing can teach you to, look at the world very freshly and in original ways. But there is in it a bit of, as in something like Hemingway's Big Two-Hearted River, a thing like, I'm describing what I see, you guess what I'm feeling.
Yeah, you know, right.
That's
right.
It was equivalent to the male, yep, nope, thing about feeling that I grew up with. And so then I wanted to find another idiom to talk, you know, as I got to a place where I wanted to deal with other kinds of emotional materials, then the haiku wouldn't do, or the four-line Buddhist description of nature.
And what was the other idiom that you found?
I don't know. There are a lot of sources for it. I mean, the first source, in a way, for all of that is always somebody like John Donne. You know, it's the poetry in which you talk about what feeling and talk about ideas. And he had done it. I don't know if it was true for you, but for me, when I was in college, Donne was the first poet whose voice, old poet whose voice sounded human, who kind of grabbed you by the lapel and started talking to you.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've also translated poems by the Polish poet Czesław Miłosz, mm-hmm. and I think of him as being very opposite to Basho and to the Chinese and Japanese poets that have influenced you. Yeah,
he's very interesting. I mean, he has.
I'm saying that because he's a kind of politically engaged poet.
Yeah, he has a double streak in him, actually, of philosophical and reflexive poetry. But there's a powerful part of him that just wants to describe the world.
In one of your essays about poetry, you wrote, "I started reading European and Latin American poets because I wanted to read a poetry by people who didn't assume that the great drama in their work was that everything in the world was happening to them for the first time."
Well, that's right. And I guess I suppose that was exactly the point at which I began to feel uneasy about what I'd gotten out of American modernism, I guess you'd say, or that part of it that interested me. As with the Chinese poetry and the Japanese poetry, poetry of William Carlos Williams and others, had that feeling of, an American beginning. "So much depends on the red wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater beside the white chickens," Williams wrote, seeing things over and over again with a new eye. Somewhere in those years of the late years of the anti-war period and the civil rights movement, when my adolescent anger began to burn off and I began to see these ancient, repetitive patterns of violence in the world, I felt like being, you know, morally outraged and surprised all the time wasn't a useful way of looking at the world. And I needed these other voices, the voices that had seen a lot and did not write from the point of view of American freshness, but from a kind of old sense of the world. The poet in whom I found that first was not Miłosz, but Zbigniew Herbert in Miłosz's translation, who wrote about politics with a terrific sense of irony that was very appealing to me.
Why don't we take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. And my guest is poet Robert Haas, and he has a new collection of poems called Human Wishes. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Robert Haas is my guest. We were talking about what sent you off to reading European and Latin American poets. You've translated some work. You've translated the work of Czesław Miłosz, the Polish poet. Has translating poems made you alert to, I know you've always been alert to this, but more alert to ambiguities in English language?
Oh, yes, it does that. It makes you also alert to how it makes me more aware of how much what kinds of language belong absolutely to what kinds of things you say that you would only say in English and what kinds of things translate.
Can you think of a line that gave you trouble in translating and how you resolved it?
Well, Yeah, it's not the funniest story of that kind. I don't know Polish. When I started working with Milosz on his poems, I knew no Polish at all. And over the years that I've worked, I've learned a little, but not enough so that I could translate with the kind of feel for language that you'd have to translate from Polish. I've always worked either with him or with some other Polish-speaking person, so which added another layer of frustration. It was sort of like, I've thought at times, making love with gloves on. You could never quite get at the actual poem. So I would work with a friend. The friend would say, this line goes, you are an echo that runs, oh dear, the word is tupochum, that runs tupochum through a train or an enfilade of rooms. And I would say, what does tupochum mean? And she would say, well, it's an onomatopoetic word. It's a word that sounds like what it's supposed to mean. And I said, well, what is it supposed to mean? And she said, well, tippy-toe. And I said, tippy-toe won't do in English. You don't want to say runs tippy-toe unless it's supposed to be silly. Is it supposed to be? No, it's not supposed to be silly. So she'd say, well, this will help. Tupocha in Lithuania is a typical name for a pet hedgehog.
Yeah, that'll help a lot.
Yeah. And so tupochum is sort of the sound that a hedgehog makes running across a hardwood floor. There are things that are just impossible to translate. And I think in that case I ended up with skittering, which isn't very good, but it was the best I could come up with. And then in the same line, there's the word enfilade, which is in an English dictionary. It means a train of rooms. Rooms that open one after another, like a series of French doors opening. And you can use it. And in Polish, they use the word enfilade. It's much fuller of French borrowed words than English is, so it's less odd in Polish than it is in English. So do you say train to give a kind of idea of a railroad, of an elegant railroad flat, or do you say enfilade, which makes it sound more aristocratic than it does in Polish? So you always have these impossible choices. Basically, as everyone says, translation is impossible.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I ended up with, you're an echo that runs skittering through a train of rooms.
Mm.
And then every time I look at it, I think, I should have said enfilade.
You can't win. Let me ask you to read something else from your new collection, Human Wishes. And this is a prose poem called In the Bahamas. And you can introduce it if you'd like, you know, in any way.
Well, I don't think it needs too much introduction.
Okay.
I was working with this little form, the little short paragraph of anecdote or narrative prose, to try to see if I could do something like casual photography in language. In the Bahamas. The doctor looked at her stitches thoughtfully, a tall, lean white man with an English manner. Have you ever watched your mum sew? He asked. The fellow who did this hadn't. I like to take a tuck on the last stitch. That way the skin doesn't bunch up at the ends. Of course, you can't see the difference, but you can feel it. Later, she asked him about all the one-armed and one-legged black men she kept seeing in the street. Diabetic gangrene, mostly. There really isn't more of it here than in your country, but there's less prosthesis. It's expensive, of course, and stumps are rather less of a shock when you come right down to it. Well, as we say, there's nothing colorful about the Caribbean. He tapped each black thread into a silver basin as he plucked it out. Have you ever been to Haiti? Now, there is a truly appalling place.
Is this a story that was told to you?
No, it was something. I actually was watching my wife have stitches that were done in the United States removed in the Bahamas, and I was watching this process go on, and it interested me, so I got it down.
Is this in part to you about how people always choose to think things are worse someplace else?
That's right.
Okay. Let me ask you to read another poem. Let me ask you to read Late Spring.
Okay. I think that's another poem about family life.
Yes, it is.
Yes, it is. And all three of my kids show up in it. The Miwok Indians I mention in it were the local peoples of the San Francisco Bay Area. And then in mid-May, the first morning of steady heat, the morning, Leaf says, when you wake up, put on shorts, and that's it for the day. When you pour coffee and walk outside, blinking in the sun. Strawberries have appeared in the markets, and peaches will soon. Squid is so cheap in the fish stores, you begin to consult Japanese and Italian cookbooks for the various and ingenious ways of preparing ika and calamari. And because the light will enlarge your days, your dreams at night will be as strange as the jars of octopus you saw once in a fisherman's boat under the summer moon. And after swimming, white wine. And the sharing of stories before dinner is prolonged because the relations of the children in the neighborhood have acquired village intensity and the stories take longer telling. And there are the nights when the fog rolls in that nobody likes. Hey, fog, the Miwok sang who lived here first. You better go home. Pelican is beating your wife. And after dark, in the first cool hour, your children sleep so heavily in their beds, exhausted from play, it is a pleasure to watch them. Leaf does not move a muscle as he lies there. No, wait, it is Luke who lies there in his 8-year-old body. Leaf is taller than you are, and he isn't home. When he is, his feet will extend past the end of the mattress, and Kristen is at the corner in the dark, talking to neighborhood boys. Things change. There is no need for this dream-compelled narration. The rhythm will keep me awake, changing.
What was the dream-compelled narration? Were you lying awake thinking about this?
Yeah, well, you lie awake playing through your head the life of your family and how it's going, and you can stop telling yourself the story as if it were in some eternal present tense, because it's going to go away. It's going to alter and become some other story.
Oh, one last thing. Since you write so many poems that your family figures into, what's your responsibility to them to not say things that will make them uncomfortable?
Well, I think I've sworn off. You know, it seemed quite natural when they were kids, but in fact, this poem, Santa Barbara Road, that I read part of, I think will be the last of it, because now my kids are mostly grown. In fact, they were here for the holidays, and when I would introduce them to people, some of them would say, people would say, oh, I know you as a character, of course, in your father's poems. And my daughter, who's doing graduate work in Ann Arbor, wandered into a bookstore, and someone asked her if she were my daughter, and she said yes, she was, to the clerk in the bookstore. And he said, were you the one in the dark talking to the neighborhood boys? So she said, knock it off, Dad, okay? So I think enough is enough. You know.
Will you miss that as far as, you know, having a subject?
I'll see. I have up to now written fairly close to the texture of my life, and they still play a large part in it, but their lives change now, you know. I'm not going to write about their relations with their girlfriends and boyfriends and so on. So probably if I do write about them, it will be in different ways, or they'll come into it perhaps in the way that, you know, the friends come into the poems by Horace or someone. Maybe I'll write Horatian poems about how life in California is to them as they're in different parts of the country.
Robert Hess, thank you for talking with us about your poetry.
Well, Terry, it's a pleasure.
Robert Hess's latest collection of poems, Human Wishes, is published by Echo Press. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. For Rick Aviles, comedy used to be a hustle, a way to make it on the New York streets. Now Aviles is making it as an actor. His latest role is in the new Jim Jarmusch film, Mystery Train. Coming up, Rick Aviles tells us how the lessons he learned doing stand-up on street corners come in handy today. You've probably never heard of Remy Ongala, but he's a household name in his native Tanzania. World music critic Milo Miles introduces us to Ongala's music. And critic-at-large Laurie Stone checks out the political humor of stand-up comic Jimmy Tingle. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush is supporting Secretary of State Baker in what turned out to be an unsuccessful effort to keep a high-level trip to China secret. The president at a White House news conference today said that Baker would not deliberately mislead the public. Barry Schwide has more.
Appearing on a Sunday television program, Baker had said that Tonks' deputy, Lawrence Eagleburger, and White House National Security Advisor Brent Scowcroft had held in China in December were the first since the crackdown on pro-democracy forces in China last summer. As it turned out, Eagleburger and Scowcroft had secretly flown to Beijing shortly after the bloody suppression. Baker said he knew about it, apologized for possibly misleading the public, and said his purpose was to protect the president's secret diplomacy. Asked about all this, Bush said, indeed, he would conduct some diplomacy in secret and that he stands by his Secretary of State. Bush acknowledged his way is controversial, but he suggested it has produced results. A decision by China to halt missile sales in the Middle East, and the readmission of a Voice of America bureau chief to Beijing. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide in Washington.
The president also said at his news conference this afternoon that his administration is not trying to arrange a plea bargaining deal with Manuel Noriega, but he also did not rule out such an arrangement. The president did not give a date for bringing U.S. servicemen now deployed in Panama back home, but said that it would be as soon as possible. The new Independent Communist Party of Lithuania today announced details of Soviet leader Gorbachev's planned trip to the Baltic Republic. The Soviet leader's visit is a follow-up to last week's Central Committee meeting called to consider the party's break in Lithuania with Moscow. NPR's Benjamin Rowe has more.
Gorbachev will arrive in Lithuania next Wednesday for 3 days of intensive meetings and some old-fashioned arm-twisting. His high-level delegation will stop in the Baltic states' major cities, holding talks with party members, workers, intellectuals, and military personnel. The plans were hammered out after a six-hour meeting at the Kremlin Thursday between Gorbachev and a group of 11 Lithuanian party members who engineered the unprecedented split from the Central Communist Party. The highly anticipated Lithuanian visit tests Gorbachev's repeated rejections of adopting any Eastern European models of rule. Gorbachev has drawn the line at the Soviet border, stating that perestroika cannot succeed without a unified Communist Party. The Central Committee plenum will resume its deliberations on the Lithuanian move shortly after the Gorbachev visit. For National Public Radio, I'm Benjamin Rowe in Vilnius, Lithuania.
In New York City on Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrials closed down almost 23 points to close at 2,773.25 on volume of some 159 million shares. Declining issues led gainers by a margin of 3-2 in moderate trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. In cultural matters, it's often forgotten how technology can mean power and status. World music critic Milo Miles explores the music of the East African country of Tanzania and how one of its popular music stars, Remy Ongala, has gone beyond the local limits.
The old conundrum goes, if a tree falls in the forest and there's no one there to hear it, does it make a noise? Media and technology have become so powerful around the world that the proper modern answer to the question is, it only makes a noise if there's somebody there to record it. How many popular music trees have fallen in impoverished Tanzania is hard to tell in the West, since the country has no recording industry to speak of. What has leaked out over the years has been tantalizing. Here's a selection done on traditional instruments. The song champions native Tanzanian culture and music pretty defensively. This is no surprise, since popular music in Tanzania has been nearly taken over by the pervasive electric guitar style from Zaire known as soukous. In fact, many of the most popular performers in Tanzania are expatriate Zairians. But the lilting, airy patterns played on a Tanzanian thumb piano, or mabira, affect the way soukous is played there. This is particularly so when the tunes are sung in the national language Swahili, as is this number by Orchestra Makasi. Although not on that recording, Zairean songwriter, singer, and guitarist Remy Ongala was a member of Orchestra Makasi. He became tremendously famous only when he began leading Orchestra Super Matamila, named after the businessman who buys them their instruments and finances their affairs. The fans call Ongala the doctor, and he is a massive culture hero at home. Trouble is, until now, it's hard to tell why. Orchestra Super Matamila had only one record readily available in the U.S., Nalilia Mawana, and it was a lo-fi affair that didn't include enough members of the band. Remy Ongala sounded pleasant enough, but sedate and derivative. But what a difference a decent studio recording and a few more upbeat songs can make. Ongala's new album, Songs for the Poor Man, was done in London with eight performers from Super Matamila. It's a smashing triumph for him as a vocalist, songwriter, and bandleader. His singing is nimble, proud, full of nuance, and he's obviously heard American soul records. The song Usingizi is about how sleep always conquers everyone, but how much easier it is to give in if you have someone to sleep with. Songs for the Poor Man also includes fairly complete lyric translations that show Ongala is a varied and compassionate writer. Not only is he a homespun philosopher with smart tunes about sleep and death, but he's uncommonly sympathetic to the inferior status of women in African society. His masterpieces, though, are songs that point out how poverty and lack of opportunity rob life of meaning and crush the spirit. A standout is The Voice of the Underdog, the story of an orphan's struggles to get by in both the city and the country village. Remy Ongala sings parables of suffering that need to be heard here as well as Tanzania.
Milo Miles is a freelance journalist who writes about pop music for The Village Voice. Remy Angala's Songs for the Poor Man is on the Virgin Real World label. This is Fresh Air. In the new film Mystery Train, Rick Aviles plays Will Robinson, the buddy of the character played by Joe Strummer of the British band The Clash. Mystery Train takes place in Memphis, far from the Lower East Side Manhattan neighborhood where Aviles grew up in a Puerto Rican family. Aviles also does stand-up comedy and was a regular on TV's It's Showtime at the Apollo, but he began his career as a street comic. It started when he was living in Boston.
There were jugglers and mimes at the time. This is about 12 years ago. But I never saw stand-up comedians. And just one day, during lunchtime, because I was working at a printing firm, one day at lunch, I just said at the top of my lungs, "It's showtime!" And I screamed out, and for about 10 seconds, I thought I'd, like, lost my mind. So what am I doing screaming at the top of my lungs in front of strangers? And I actually gathered a crowd, and I did, like, some impressions. And that was the start of it. I mean, I think I made, like, $5 that day, and that was it. I was hooked.
What are some of the locations you've played over the years?
I used to do in the front of the library and on Fifth Avenue on 42nd Street and in the back of the library, which is called Bryant Park. I performed in Central Park, Washington Square Park, right inside the fountain. I used to stand on a hydrant on Bleecker Street, and there was also another hydrant that I would stand on. And it wasn't one of those pointy hydrants. I mean, it was there was one of those things with the two spouts coming out of them, so it was flat, so I could stand. There was one on 6th Avenue in Greenwich Village as well. So,
did you ever do trains?
Oh, yeah, yeah. For a while, it got cold. You know, I mean, I supported myself for a while doing stand-up. And when it got cold, you couldn't perform on the street. I remember when it hit 50 degrees, I knew it was time. Or under 50 degrees, it was time to go underground. And in the case of subways, it definitely was underground. But I used to perform, like, on the A train between, there was an express stop from 59th Street to 125th Street. And that's a long ride, so, I mean, I could do a nice show. And I used to tell the people, I hope you don't think I was doing this for free. I didn't have to be here. I could have been in your house taking your stereo, so please give generously.
Did people get intimidated when you'd say that?
I think so. I didn't want to scare them. But, I also didn't want to work for free either, so.
One of the things that you do when you're doing stand-up is different ethnic variations. Like, you do different versions of someone selling dope, and you have, like, a black dealer, a Jewish dealer, a Hispanic dealer. You do a thing where you do different gay people, like a black gay, a white gay, a Hispanic gay. Do people ever get offended when you do your ethnic impressions? And what's the way to do it without being offensive?
Well, I don't think... I might have heard one person in 12 years tell me that they were offended. And, I mean, that's a good percentage. I like not to offend anyone. The way you do it to not offend is to be accurate in your characterizations and also in your setup. Like, you know, there's a line that I do before I do, like, ethnic queens. And I say, you know, where do gay people come from? You know, and I say, our families. Where do you think they come from? A planet Homo, and they're invading? No, like, they come here. There's a cousin, there's a nephew, there's a brother, a sister. I said, and I talk about how I dislike comedians that make fun of gays. I said, but it's fun to watch queens, and that's how I set it up. And I do, like, you know, these mincing queens, like the black queen. That's right, Miss Thing, your mother loves it, child. And the Puerto Rican queen, oh, he's so cute, I want to know his name. Oh, I love him. And the white queen is like, oh, I'm so mad. Philip is so insensitive. You know what I mean? It's accurate. I mean, everybody knows somebody like that, also has heard that voice before. So, you know, it's hard to be offended at truth. And there's honesty in my work.
When did you start moving indoors from performing on the streets, and how did you start doing it?
I think I made that transition about 5 years ago. I met a woman who was a lawyer and wasn't doing much with her law degree. And we sort of both came to the decision that maybe she and I would do well in business, her acting as my manager. And she's the one who, like, sort of decided, Rick, it's time to not give it away on the streets anymore. And we started doing more club dates, inside dates.
Did you start finding that your timing had to change when you were playing in clubs instead of on the street?
No, not so much. In fact, you have to maintain the same energy that you do on the street as you do in a club. At least I do, because if I find that I'm just standing in front of a microphone trying to be funny as opposed to putting my all into it and giving it the same street kind of energy, that then I'm really cheating my audience and cheating myself as a performer. I do want to, you know, emphasize that another reason I had to get away from street performing, and why she insisted so much on me not street performing, is that I started to view my work as a hustle. I mean, a hustle is a way to make money quickly. That's why I viewed it as a hustle.
Uh-huh.
It's an outlaw kind of thing, too. I didn't have there's no license to street perform, and there's no one telling you when you're on this, so there's really no holes barred in when you can perform or how much time you have to perform. So you almost feel like an outlaw when you're doing it. And because you made quick money, it's instant gratification, you know?
Mm-hmm. There was a period, I understand, when your career kind of took a nosedive and that you were having a lot of problems yourself, and you were even living on the streets for a while. Is that right?
Things were really bad. And there again, I mean, that goes right back to street performing and hustling. See, when you make that money fast, you tend to spend it fast. And I didn't have a lot of values when I was street performing. I wanted to make money, and I got involved with drugs. I mean, I had a big drug problem, and that just kind of made, like, you know, career is on hold if you're really involved with drugs. And I mean, some people can do it, but I certainly couldn't. I mean, there was definitely, I was supposed to show up on an audition, and, you know, I'd be nodding off in the corner somewhere, and yeah, there was a real dark period in my life.
Mm-hmm. In Mystery Train, the character that you play is actually black. I was wondering if that made a difference to you. Do you know what I mean? Playing someone who is black instead of Hispanic.
No, not at all. I thoroughly loved playing that character. And Jim Jarmusch is such a wise director. I mean, he brought us down. He brought me down like a week earlier and some other people down a little earlier just to get a feel of Memphis. And an interesting thing about playing a black character, for a long time I had an identity crisis because I'm Hispanic, but we spoke English at home. So, I mean, my main hangout was with, you know, inner city blacks. I mean, I grew up thinking, you know, like, my name should have been Johnson, you know what I'm saying? but it was sort of easy for me to play a black. What was difficult was playing a southern black. I mean, mm-hmm. and it sort of challenging for me to try to be convincing, you know, as a black southerner. I mean, a native Memphian. And I don't know, I thought I did okay. And some other people have told me that they liked my work. So I'm not going to be too critical. Because every time I see the film, well, I could have done that a little deep. Well, it could have been more sudden, you know. So I don't know. But I have no qualms. I think someone asked me, well, what do you want? I said, well, I'm looking for that to play the white guy. I mean, if a dark-skinned Hispanic can play black, I mean, why don't I get that long hair and for that business there, a Biff role out there for me?
Biff, yes? How's it going? Fine. Just great.
I imagine there's even fewer Hispanic roles than there are black roles in movies and TV.
Yeah, I think there's not a lot. But it seems to me that there are a lot more now than there were before. And that might be, and there might be a lot of roles opening up, because you can just imagine, they're gonna do a Noriega film, you know. And I think Edward Almos would be a great Noriega.
What part do you see for yourself?
Well, one of those generals or somebody there. There's got to be something I can do.
Well, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, I'm so glad you had me on here.
Actor and comic Rick Aviles.
I bet if a cockroach could talk, they would be upset. Boy, they'd band together and say to humans, spray me! Spray me! You decon my mother! And your black flag, my fault. You tried to raid my baby sister. Now you want to check me into one of those motels?
Hey, take care now. Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with Robert Siegel. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. Today we hope to be hearing from Noah Adams and Andrei Codrescu again in Romania. Also from Moscow about Mikhail Gorbachev's talks with Lithuanian communists. You know, the Lithuanian party broke with the Soviet Communist Party. He's been trying to patch things up. He travels to the Baltic Republic next week. But now we hear accounts from Lithuanian communists that the Soviet president is a bit more understanding of their position in the negotiations they've had. Also, a report on no-fault divorce. It's the 20th anniversary of that institution. And a look at the future of the Panamanian military.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Critic at large Laurie Stone often talks about comedy on our show, and she's often disappointed by the lack of good political humor. But she's found another political comic that she likes, Jimmy Tingle.
Over the years, I've seen Jimmy Tingle hone his act in New York clubs, but last winter at Caroline's and again this summer at the Montreal Comedy Festival, he showed unprecedented confidence and coherence. It's exciting when a performer takes this kind of leap and deepens, expands. Tingle can now be added to the small but significant list of political comics, including Harry Shearer, Louis Black, Will Durst, and Richard Belzer. These performers do more than take potshots at the physical mannerisms of politicians. They critique the injustice and greed steering policy. Short, dirty blonde hair juts up from Tingle's forehead. He has the open-faced good looks and contained energy James Cagney projected.
Well, B-1 bomber crashed last January, right? The plane cost $280 million to build. The plane crashed because it did not come equipped with de-icer. What? $280 million on a plane to protect North America? No de-icer? Come on, will you? I mean, a Volkswagen has defrost. I like doing the political stuff, folks, because everything is political. For instance, the AIDS crisis is very political. Nobody in positions of power in the United States was coming down with that disease. And the way everybody heard about the disease was, there's a strange new disease sweeping the country. It's killing Haitians, homosexuals, and drug addicts, and there's no cure. And all the politicians are going, yeah. What's the problem? They're living that immoral lifestyle. There's nothing we can do. We're sorry. It's the will of God. Of course, 9 years later, well, you can also get it from a prostitute. Well, something should be done.
I met with Tingle one afternoon recently, and he talked about comedy as a creative arena. When he started out, it was the one performing outlet he could imagine for himself. He was raised in Cambridge, Massachusetts, the oldest of four kids. His father drove a cab. His mother worked in a medical lab. In his neighborhood, kids either went into crime, or they went into sports, or they went to school, although Tingle recalls it wasn't hip to be smart. He made it to college anyway and studied history. He wanted to perform, but he didn't know any actors. He was funny with his friends in bars, but he was unsure how to harness this talent. The turning point came in 1980 when he saw Rodney Dangerfield for the first time. He was blown away. Dangerfield's street-smart, pretension-busting persona was a fitting inspiration. Soon after, a comedy club opened in Cambridge, 3 blocks from where Tingle was living. The Ding Ho Club would shortly launch as well. Stephen Wright, Steve Sweeney, Paula Poundstone, Jim Morris, Kevin Meaney, and Barry Crimmins. Tingle worked as daytime bartender, doorman, janitor, and open mic performer, slowly drawing courage from the talented cohort and piecing together an act. From the beginning, his theme was the system versus the little man. Tingle feels the hard part is holding onto himself while trying to get on TV. He's appeared on Carson, and he's auditioned for Letterman, a show with a bias against political comedy. He hasn't yet been offered a shot there, but he isn't waiting for that imprimatur. He's been encouraged by Reno and Sandra Bernhardt, and he's developing a one-man show that makes him feel juiced and creative. Tingle is an entertainer, but foremost, he wants to please himself, and that's the attitude that puts the show in show business.
Lurie Stone is a New York-based writer and critic, and is a contributor to The Village Voice. Jimmy Tingle is featured on the Strange Bedfellows comedy recording on the A&M label. Naomi Person produces our commentaries and music reviews. Our interviews are produced by Amy Salad and Phyllis Myers. Joan Tuohy and Roberta Shorrock are our production assistants. I'm Terry Gross, and I'm heading off on vacation. Sedge Thompson from KQED in San Francisco will be sitting in for me. Talk to you when I get back.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet one of Canada's leading novelists, Robertson Davies. And Eddie L. Harris tells us about his journey down the Mississippi, 2,300 miles by canoe from Minnesota to the Gulf of Mexico. That and more coming up on the next Fresh Air.